into what the world needs now. Before we bring in our guest, Dr. Gilbert Lavoie, just a reminder that coming up on Tuesday, October the 17th, is one of our two major fundraisers that we have each year. It'll be our annual golf outing. The venue has changed this year. We'll be at Tallamore Country Club in Ambler, Pennsylvania. And there's plenty of room for additional golfers. It's always a great day. We get started at 11 o'clock with lunch, a 12 o'clock shotgun start for golf. There'll be a cocktail hour from 5 to 6, dinner at 6, a silent auction, and just a great day to be had by all. You can download a flyer or pamphlet with all the information from our website at inhissign.com. If you scroll to the bottom of the homepage, download that, and it'll tell you about all the sponsorship opportunities and how to register to play golf or just come for dinner that evening. Again, we can't thank you enough for all that you do for us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio. And because of your financial contributions as well as your prayers, we've been on the air for over 40 years and able to bring you great shows like today's. And today I am joined by Dr. Gilbert Lavoie, and he's a medical doctor and also specializes in internal medicine and occupational medicine as well as public health. He has pursued a forensic and scriptural study of the Shroud of Turin for more than 40 years, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. Welcome to the show, Doctor. It's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be with you, Ken.
And Dr. Lavoie's written a new book. It's called The Shroud of Jesus and the Sign John Ingeniously Concealed. And usually I don't have an opportunity, Doctor, to talk to my guests for as long as we chatted the other night, and I'm certainly glad we did. I managed to finish the book between then and now, and can't recommend it enough. Yeah, no, for our listeners. It was one of those things where once you got started and saw where it was headed, you wanted to get to the end and see how it played out. And I it turns out I had seen one of your videos from way back when. I had mentioned to you when we talked that a gentleman in our prayer group had passed the video around to some of the guys. And this book is a new and updated version. And I think and we'll get into it, that the main thing that it did for me was really unpack the Gospel of St. John, which is something I didn't expect when I first picked up the book. So, again, welcome to the show, Doctor. It's great to have you with us. What, after 40 years, made you decide to write yet another book about the Shroud?
Well, actually, to decide to make another book was over time. This is a process. You start and you get into something. For example, it started many years ago when I was a freshman at college and was in pre-med. And the only reason I knew about the Shroud is I went into this old bookstore and found a book called The Doctor of Calvary by Dr. Pierre Barbet. And I thought it was just a book about the crucifixion of Jesus, and then I discovered about the Shroud. And then I was fascinated, and I put it aside. And about 18 years later, after starting a practice, 1978, I opened the Boston Globe, and there was a picture of the Shroud. And so I decided to go. My wife, I said, "What do you say we go and check this out?" And so we went over there and checked it out, and it was fascinating. I was very, very fortunate to have met a group of scientists that were actually doing the studies. Some of those people have become long colleagues for many, many years. Unfortunately, a number of them have passed away since that time. But I was able to go to the conference that they had there and also take photographs. But when I came back, I wasn't quite sure if I was going to get involved. I was skeptical. I started as a skeptic. I had my own faith, and I didn't really need the Shroud at all. However, I got interested in a blood mark that was an off-image blood mark, and I studied that, and finally I discovered after studying it for a while that indeed it was truly a crucified man in this cloth. And that's really what got me started originally. And then I ended up spending years of doing more and more work and wrote a book and wrote a number of articles. And finally did a video, maybe that's 25 years ago. And over these past 25 years, I've been continuing with my interest. And then I, not only the interest in the shroud itself, but the interest in the Gospel of John. Actually, I took 2 years of study with regard to 2 years of in a university, basically studying the Bible, graduate courses, and then I studied the Gospel of John probably intensely for about 10 years, and which enabled me to do what I did in this book with regard to the Gospel of John. What happened was that how I really got started in this last book was I had been giving lectures actually to prisoners, and I used my old video to do that, and then one day I couldn't bring the video in, and then I realized that you really need photographs in order to discuss this. We can discuss it on radio, but if you're going to discuss it in really in depth, you need photographs. I didn't have them that day, and I came out of there and I said, I better write a book and get this all together and put my photographs in and so forth. So I got started in writing a new book, and I came with this book. Particular book has about 80 photographs, and the beauty of this book, I think, is that one can look at it. And anything I say about the shroud, actually you can see it. And then you can make up your own mind whether or not you believe this is really the shroud of Jesus or not. And then you can even go a lot further than that and realize what a real gift God has given us, and that God has communicated to us actually through the shroud, the image of Jesus, and the blood of Jesus.
And that, Doctor, is why I could not put the book down as a, you know, going through it, and because of the way it's written and all the documentation, the photographs that are there, that if you were to just look at the shroud yourself, you'd never, you know, get to where you've gotten. And obviously, you've spent 40 years of your life looking at this, in addition to your regular work as a doctor, and the way the book was written and the way it was unpacked, I think was ideal. And even that, and we'll get into this at some point, I guess. But even the your own experiments that you did with your own subjects, in order to prove some of these things, I found absolutely fascinating.
Well, go ahead. Yeah.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
Most of the book is original work that I've done. I have, of course, met a number of colleagues, and there's some wonderful work that's in there from other people, because this is something that builds on from person to person. And so I have several chapters there with other people's input and so forth. You know, it's interesting, over life, you think that things go on forever, but they don't. I've got some friends of mine that I've written about in that book that are passed away, and when I was doing the interviews with them, I thought that, I never thought that they'd pass away in a sense. I mean, but now you look back, I'm glad that I documented what they had to say about the shroud, and it's in the book. And these are fellows that had firsthand work with it. I mean, they were touching the shroud, they were picking at it and so forth, trying to find out what it was all about, what that image was about, and that's all documented here in the book. So for people who really want to get down to the ground level of what this cloth is about and what the image is about and the blood marks, I think, you know, this is where to go.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. So just starting with the linen itself. So and it was that. It was a linen, and many tests have been done over the years, that, and you've documented them about how we know that it's from the time that Christ walked on the earth, and as well as from that specific area. And maybe for our listeners, how we know that it came from that particular area of the world.
I think for some of your listeners, probably I'll just start with the cloth itself. It's a cloth that's 14 feet by 3.5 feet. On this cloth is the very faint image of the front and back of a naked man, and on that also is blood marks, and those blood marks are very consistent with exactly what the gospel writer John has to say about the passion and death of Jesus. What John writes is on the shroud, and what's on the shroud is what John writes, and nothing more. It's really quite amazing, which really brought me to really want to study more about John, because he really and truly was the witness who saw the crime. And there it is. That's now, as far as the there's also some parallel brown lines that are on each side of the image, and they occurred in a fire in 1532. Fortunately, the shroud was saved. But so the cloth is made of linen, it's flax, and herringbone weave. And as far as the age is concerned, there's two marvelous studies that that people can really appreciate. One of them is pollen studies. I met with Dr. Max Fry back in 1978, and Dr. Max Fry did the pollen studies. And I can remember talking to him, and he said, I spent 5 years of my life traveling in order to find areas where the pollens that I found on the cloth, actually from where they came from. And he reported that these pollen spores were not only in France and Italy, but they were in Asia Minor and all the way down into Palestine and Jerusalem. So we have an itinerary of this cloth. It's fabulous, and I was fortunate, like I said, to meet this man who did the work. And I have there's a lot in that book regarding that in the back pages, if you are interested. Anyway, another study that was done, that's sort of a biological study. Then there's an archaeological study that was actually done by the woman who restored the shroud in 2002. When she was doing the work, she found there's a strip along it's maybe a 3 or 4 inch strip that goes the whole length of the shroud, and that strip was sewed on to the main cloth, and we know that it happened at the time the cloth was actually used as a burial cloth, because it's the very same cloth. For some reason, it's a herringbone weave. We know it's the very same cloth. And what was important about that was the stitch itself that was used to sew that together. She was Fleury Lumberg is her name, and she did the restoration of the shroud, like I said, in 2002. And what she discovered was that this stitch is absolutely unique. The only place that it has been found so far is Masada, which is about a two to three day walk from Jerusalem, and the city of Masada was actually destroyed in about 73-74 AD by the Romans. So that stitch brings you to just a couple days walk from Jerusalem, and brings you to a date before very near the time of Christ. That's a fascinating work. That's something that no one can ignore, finding that. And one other good study that was done, it was a recent one, with regard to the date. It was an X-ray diffraction study, and actually they used cloth from Masada and the shroud, and they found that they nearly matched as far as age was concerned. So as far as it being 2,000 years old, it is 2,000 years old. The carbon dating study that was done in 1988 is really gone past the wayside now. A study was done in 2019. It came out saying that, you know, they looked at the statistics and they got all of the statistics that they hadn't been able to get before, and they found that that there was not homogeneous and there was a problem with that, so that study is not a good study. It has to, they want to do carbon dating, they have to repeat that. But it's, we know that it's 2,000 years old, so we're, you know, and plus the fact that all the data, you know, points to this being the Shroud of Jesus.
Very good. There's a chapter in here called the Shroud Under a Microscope, and you talk about the way that some of the images were, or what was actually on the linen, and how it didn't penetrate, which was, I found it incredible, and it's in, I think, nanometers is the depth of it, so.
That's incredible. What, and also for our audience, we sort of want to think in terms, when you're looking at the cloth, you have to think that the two events took place on this cloth. In one event, the first event that took place was that a man who was crucified, it was taken down from the crucified position, was then placed on his back on one end of this cloth, and the other end was placed over him. And as they wrapped him, and they wrapped him very carefully because the blood marks were not actually disturbed, and that would indicate a Jewish burial, because the Jewish people were very concerned about life's blood that was on there, and that's what we have, the life's blood, the blood that flows at the time of death. And they were very concerned about that, and so they were very careful in taking him down not to disturb any of those blood marks. But anyway, so that the blood marks were moist enough, so when they... let me put it this way. He was full of blood, and most of that blood dried. And the only blood marks that we really see are the last blood flows that were on his body, and those were moist. So when he wrapped him, the blood marks, the blood that was on his body soaked into the cloth. And you can see in micrographs and so forth how the blood just seeped in between the fibers and so forth. And it actually soaked through to the back of the cloth. That's one thing. We know that came first, because if you take that blood off of the, you remove the blood from the cloth itself, you find that there's no image under the blood. So whatever caused the image did not penetrate the blood. Is that we find no image under the blood. So therefore, blood came first, image came second. Now the image is fascinating because when one looks at it, a thread, and it's made up of many fibers. These fibers are flax, and it's a cellulose material. And these fibers are way less than the hairs on your head, way less than the hairs on your head, and in diameter. And so they're very tiny. And when you look at under the microscope at 64 times magnification, which we have a beautiful picture of in the book, you can see them for yourself. You can see there's really no paint at all on there, but you just see the yellowing of individual fibers, and they're next to fibers that are actually white, that haven't been colored at all. And the yellowing comes from what they call an oxidative dehydration, and simply that's sort of a degradation of cellulose. It's like being at your mother's grandmother's or something, and she has a pot on the table There's a linen cloth there. It's been there a long time. You pick it up, and the center is white, and the outside is sort of yellowed. And it's just the sun and whatever, that the degradation of the cellulose. That's what happened there. But now, as far as you can yellow these fibers with acid, heat, and light, but the image itself has never been recreated at the microscopic level. And these fibers, the image only goes down into the fiber, mainly one, in some places two fibers, that's all. So it's very, very superficial. And no one even can recreate this image. Nobody has, and people have a lot of hypotheses, and they talk about different ways it could happen, but no one has actually done it. So so there's two events, the blood marks and the image marks. And of course, the image is something very special.
Yeah. Absolutely. So again, our guest today is Dr. Gilbert Lavoie, and we're discussing his book, The Shroud of Jesus and the Sign John Ingeniously Concealed. It's published by Sophia Institute. You can pick it up on Sophia's website here in the Philadelphia market. I'd encourage you to get in touch with our friends at the St. Jude Shop. If they don't have it in stock already, they probably do, but if they don't, they can get it for you on short order. And like I said, Doctor, I found it fascinating, especially the scientific approach, because I guess it's almost beyond a reasonable doubt now that this is what we originally thought it to be, and all the scientific evidence that you lay out in the book. And really, the second image that we're talking, so you have the image that has the blood marks, and the second image that's on there was not originally seen. Am I correct in saying that until the end of the 19th century when somebody took a photograph of it?
Yes, that's a fascinating story. And an amateur photographer, a lawyer, Secunda Pia, in 1998, took the first photograph of the shroud. And of course, in those days, they had these great big cameras, negative plates. And so when he went into his dark room and he was looking at the negative plate, all of a sudden what happened was this beautiful positive face comes out on the negative. And he just felt he was looking at the face of Jesus for the first time. And he had to think about why that we had this beautiful positive image of the on a negative plate. And then he realized that what was on the original that we see on the cloth itself is actually a negative, and the negative becomes a positive when you take the photograph. And the interesting part of that also is that on the cloth itself, the blood is positive. I mean, it's blood that's on that cloth, so it's positive. But on the negative, it looks negative. So we have on the shroud, the cloth itself has a negative body, positive blood. We get to the negative, we have a positive image, and we have negative blood. It really was the start it started scientists getting very excited about the shroud, and people have been asking, this is about, 125 years ago, and they've been asking the question, a negative photo get onto an ancient cloth? Nobody's really been able to answer that question in over 125 years. The black and white photography is what really brings out a magnificent image. And it's got to be done very well. Vernon Miller, who did this work, he was the scientific photographer that really did the work of all the beautiful pictures in 1978, and all those pictures are actually in my book here. I knew Vern Miller; we became great friends. And in fact, we actually did a when he passed away, a friend of mine and I, Tom Mac, Dee Mahala and I put together a website called shroudphotos.com. It has all these beautiful pictures, and people can look at them and actually download them for free. There's rules. You can't put them back on the Internet or anything. There's certain rules you can't, but you can download a beautiful picture and put it in your living room or put it in a book or whatever, or an article or something. But those are available free throughout the world. So that was done. We accomplished that. We started in 2012, and we accomplished it in 2019. So that's, those are available to people.
Yeah, what amazed me as I read about the photography that was involved was that if they had waited until today, where you know there's not a whole lot of photography being done with that uses film anymore, where you get your pictures with the sleeve and negatives that go with it, they may have gone undiscovered if we had waited another 100 years before they
Right. In other words, the picture of the fate would have faded, huh? Yeah. And what happens is the background is darkening, and so as it continues darkening, you will lose the ability to see the photograph, to see the man of the shroud. And that's the concern. So now they have it under a certain particular gases, whatever, and they take good care of it, trying to prevent that from continuing. Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned early on about your studies of the Gospels and theology courses, but you spent a lot of time and you dedicated a chapter to it about the Jewish burial custom that I found fascinating, because when you first read the Gospel, and I think if you don't pay real close attention to it, that we all think that they had cleaned Jesus' body, and if they had, where would this blood have come from? But yeah, I think you did a great job of explaining the Jewish burial custom that was done then and done now. And it sounds like you've got quite a library.
What happened was it's interesting. I do have a Mishnah at my home. It's interesting that what happened was that when I started deciding to do some work on this and try to understand the blood marks, I decided if I'm going to start looking at blood marks, I better understand how Jewish people, you know, actually buried their dead. And because at the time I was starting this, there was two camps. One camp said, the general rule for Jewish people, you know, and the old days, even today, was the fact that what you had to basically wash the body prior to burial. And so in the Gospel of John, it says that Jesus was buried according to Jewish custom, and so there's been this argument going on for many, many years. It went on for years until I actually wrote my first paper on this. And the argument was this, if this can't be the body of Jesus, because there's blood all over it, and he was buried according to the Jewish custom. The Jewish custom is to wash the body. So that was one camp. The other camp said, well, that's true, but, you know, the Sabbath was imminent. They had to hurry up, and they buried him almost according to the Jewish custom, except they didn't have time to wash the body. So that's what the argument was when I got involved in it. And then I started studying this, and I realized that you couldn't find out anything about this through the Catholic world. You had to really join into the Jewish world and understand what was going on. And it brought me back and back into history. And it was it took a year and a half to get this study done. And but it finally happened. And we just basically discovered through actually a colleague of mine that there was an exception to the rule of washing. And the exception was that if a man dies a violent death and blood flows at the time of death, the body is not washed, but he's simply wrapped in a sheet and buried. And that's exactly what we find on the shroud. So Jesus was buried to the Jewish custom, the exception of the Jewish custom of washing, but it was still the Jewish custom not to wash the body because the concern was that the blood would come. It would be life's blood, the blood that flows. They quantitated it and qualitated it. They qualitated by saying it was the blood that flows at the time of death, number one. And the other thing is they quantitated it. It had to be at least what they said, a quarter of a log of blood. Now, a log of blood is about six eggs, so a quarter of a log of blood is an egg and a half, a small cup of, the size of a small cup of wine. So there we have it. We have, and so that's what's on there, and that's why the blood is on there, because Jesus died a violent death. So, and the interesting part of it is, a very interesting part, is that this blood is considered life's blood. You know, your life depends on it. You've lost this amount, you die. It's life's blood, and that is considered the blood of atonement. Okay, the blood of atonement, imagine, that's in the Jewish world. So what we see on Jesus' body, on the shroud, is Jesus' lifeblood, the blood of atonement. Amazing. It's amazing.
Absolutely amazing. And then you went on to do a number of your own, I guess for lack of a better word, experiments with the blood. And we could probably talk about this for a few hours, but in lumping those experiments along with the something you mentioned at the outset, which was key to you, and that was the off-image drop of blood. If you could explain what that drop of blood was, and maybe some of your own experiments that you performed with current, you know, people that are still alive today.
Oh yeah, well, what happened was that that off-image blood mark that really got me interested in this whole thing was a. It's hard to really do this on the phone because people can't see it, but it comes down to this. It's all in the book. All the photographs are there. But I didn't know how that off-image blood mark got there. But one day I placed a cloth over, I had a friend of mine who had the full size copy of the shroud, and he'd let me borrow it once in a while. So I covered my body with it, and then I realized when the cloth came around the side of my arm, I realized exactly what had happened. And then I studied that some more, and I wrote out, put some pictures together. And what would happen was that, just to make it, we'll start from the beginning to understand it, is that he was nailed to a cross, and the blood comes down, and you, but one arm is about at the elbow, it's really at 90 degrees. So the blood comes straight down the arm, and then it flows around the elbow to the back of the arm, and then it forms a pool and drips off the ground, which is fascinating because when you read in the Mishnah about the crucified, they talk about blood gushing from the crucified or dripping from the crucified, and this was dripping from the crucified. And this feeling that everybody gets that feeling when, for example, if you're shaving, guys, if they're shaving, they can feel that water drip down your arm and, you know, around the elbow and drip to the ground. Or if you're washing washing dishes, you know, your hands are wet, and you bring up your arms and you say, can you hand me that towel? And therefore, so you can feel that water dripping around down your arm and under the back of the arm, and then dripping down to the ground. So it's a real phenomena, and that's what you see there on the cloth. And so that particular blood mark tells you without any doubt that Jesus died, the man of the shroud died in the crucified position. That's number one. It tells you that. The second thing it tells you is that the blood mark is simply a contact process. Blood, cloth coming in contact with the moist blood clot and sort of basically soaking into the cloth. Finally, the this information is very interesting because it gives you because it's on the he's lying on his back, and the back of his arm, of course, is to the side of his body, not in front of his body. The forearm is in the front of the body, but the back of the arm is, of course, to the side of the body. So you see that the cloth literally has to drape around the arm to the back of the arm and then pick up the blood mark. So it does that. It picks up the blood mark, and we know the cloth touched the back of the arm as well as the front of the arm, yet there, when you look at that area, there's no image of the back of the arm, yet the cloth, we know, touched the back of the arm because of the blood being there. So the blood is a contact process, a natural event, but the image is not a contact process because there's no image there where we know that the cloth touched the back of the arm. So it isn't organic matter and so forth on the body that was responsible for the image. We don't know it's responsible, and it was not a contact process. And then the other thing that's fascinating about this particular blood mark is that all the other blood marks sort of give you height and width of the body, but this blood mark gives you the third dimension, depth. In other words, you know that there was a human being that was wrapped in this cloth. So these are, you know, that blood mark is very, very significant. It tells you a lot of things, points you in a lot of directions.
That's what I kind of picked up on, because I was fascinated that because of that, it would have been the right arm that was in 90 degrees, and the left arm would have been stayed in the natural crucified position. But I think it also, if I'm not mistaken, it told you which foot was on top of which. That arm to bend the way it did.
Right. It was a very interesting thing. I had a friend of mine, actually John Jackson. He does some beautiful work. He's done wonderful work on the Shroud. Beautiful guy. And he asked me to come over to his place in Colorado and help him out, because he wanted to find out what position Jesus was in when he was crucified. So I brought normal saline and something to tint blood with and whatever, and we had a couple volunteers come in. They were young men. We nailed them to the cross. No, we didn't do that. we had leather straps, and I even had a physician there. Asked him. He said, "Well, you're a physician. Why don't you?" You're all right. And I said, "No, I'm not licensed in your state. And if something happens, we'll just have to bring them to the emergency room, and I won't know anybody, but you need somebody that really knows what they're doing and has contacts there." So another physician came in. "Well, were you doing all this?" And just to be sure everything was going very well, and if something happened, we were very careful about doing this. I'm not going to get into the details, but it was exceedingly well done. No one got hurt. Everybody was fine. But we had leather straps, and we had swivels on the straps. And so I asked, John, if I said, I like to put a swivel on the foot as well, because I think there's only one nail there, and I think that I want to see what happens if we have a swivel on the foot. He agreed, and so we did that. And I remember that we were actually looking at the blood marks, and John and I were talking about them, and we were trying to predict. He and I were predicting the position the body would be in. First of all, the left foot is on the shroud is over the right foot, and so that's how we placed the individual with his left foot over his right. And then, we just said, John says, "Well, let's put him on the cross, see what happens." So that's what we did. After we had the discussion of what we thought would happen. And so the young man, we put him up there, and he was fine. He was sort of balancing on this on his swivel at his feet, and then all of a sudden, thud, he falls into a position, and he falls into the exact position that we had predicted. And so I said to him, I said, did you hear what we were talking about? What happened here? I says, did you hear us? No. He says, no, I can't help it. This is, I fell in this direction. I can't move from this direction. The poor guy. And so we were actually, it was so unbelievable to see what we had predicted exactly happened. And so we actually stopped everything, took him down or whatever, and just sat around for about 15 minutes in awe, realizing that we were really seeing a position that Jesus was in, 2,000 years ago, because it absolutely fit exactly what. And so what happens to you, when the body, if your left foot is over your right, you're going to push yourself to the right, and the right arm will go into a 90-degree angle to the cross, and the other one will just stretch out. If you change that, and that's what we did, we had him put his right foot over his left, and just the opposite happened. So what we have there, exactly what we see happening with the blood marks, happens in real life. So it's a real, true crucifixion type of position that Jesus is in, and that's why we see the blood marks as we do. It was a wonderful, exciting experiment to realize that that's indeed what we see on the shroud is indeed true to a true crucifixion. Amazing.
One more time, our guest today is Dr. Gilbert Lavoie, and we're talking about the book he's written called The Shroud of Jesus and the Sign John Ingeniously Concealed. And we've only got about 15 minutes left, Doctor. So one of the things that I also noticed is that the nails in his did not go through his hands but through his wrists, and I think he documented that as well.
I want to give credit where it's supposed to be. That's Dr. Barbet's wonderful work. What he did is what happens is was you put the nails through the wrist. What he did, he lived and did this work in the 1930s and 40s and during the war and all that. And I had to amputate arms, and he noticed the fact that the blood mark at the wrist shows that the arm is in like about 60 degrees from the vertical, and it shows that he's in a crucified position because the blood drips down in a particular angle that is showing that the arm was in a crucified position. But he also noticed that there were basically the thumbs. He saw four fingers and no thumbs, and so he first of all he worked with cadavers, and he found that if he put the nails through the palms of the hands, the body weight would just tear through the flesh, and he wouldn't hold them up. Had to put it through the wrist. So the wrist is exactly correct that we see there on the shroud. And the other thing was that when that was done, when he amputated an arm from a person because he needed to, it was an injury or whatever, and the flesh was still sort of living, put a nail through the wrist, and the thumb would hit the median nerve, and the thumb would actually come into the palm of the hand and leave you with four fingers and no thumb. And so everything about this is truly that of a crucifixion from an anatomical perspective.
For our listeners, you really need to have the book to see the pictures and what have you of how all of this plays out. But one of the highlights for me in this book was the amount of time that you spent studying the Gospel of John and related to the images. And in the conversation that we had last night, you had you mentioned that how we want to get this book into the hands of young people, because it absolutely, at least to me, and that's why I wanted to get through the book. It actually proves a whole lot about what we believe as Catholics and Christians. So maybe take the remainder of the show and maybe lay out for our listeners what you found.
Yeah, so anyway, when I had studied this shroud for a number of years, and I was fascinated by the fact that it was a superficial image, that no one could something that no one could do. No one knew how it happened. I was fascinated because it was definitely crucified man. In the 45 years I've been doing this, any lecture I've ever given to physicians or whatever, nobody ever asks me if this man is crucified, because the forensics are so powerful. It's definitely a man that's crucified, no question. Never once was I asked that question after making a presentation. But even though I've discovered these things, people kept saying, well, this has to be the moment of the resurrection. But I said, in my own mind, I didn't say very much, but I just quietly thought, there's nothing in this cloth that can convince me or has convinced me that this is the moment of the resurrection, even though we have these wonderful things. And so one day I was doing another study on the face, blood on the face, and realized as I was doing that I actually had taken a photograph of my colleague. We were working on the blood. I had him. I said, "You go." First of all, he was sitting at the dining room table, and I just happened to snap a picture of him, and I said, "Well, that's not going to work." I said, "The man of the shroud is actually lying down, so you have to lie down here, and I'll take your picture." He did. He was a bearded man. And so, actually, when I got the photographs back, in those days we had negatives and positives, and so I said, "I'm going to look at the negative of my volunteer who was lying down, and that should look somewhat like the shroud." And so when I looked at it, because the shroud is a negative, so when I compared the negative to the negative of my volunteer to the photograph of the shroud on the cloth, I was shocked because it wasn't the same. And I said, here's something, you know, with always a skeptic, here's the problem and whatever, this is not really a negative, et cetera, et cetera. And then I went through the rest of my negatives, and all of a sudden I came across a negative of the very same individual, but it was the picture that I had, the photograph I had taken him in the upright position, and that negative looked very much like the shroud face. It had light areas around the eyes, under the nose, and at the lips like shadows. And therefore, I sensed that the man of the shroud was not lying down, but that he was upright. And that was just an awesome moment of my life, sort of an epiphany. I literally walked out of the room, backed out of the room, in awe of this, thinking in terms that this was the moment of the resurrection, because the man of the shroud is not lying down, but he's upright. So then I came back in the room and continued to study, and I looked and realized that the same phenomenon was happening at the chest, light areas under the pectoral muscles, between the fingers and under the hand. So it's the shadows basically consistent with an upright person. So then I pursued that some more, and then I realized, my gosh, the obvious was sitting there. The man's hair comes down to his shoulders and down his back, as a position of a person who is upright with long hair. Position, when you lie down, the hair would fall back. This was not the case. This was hair falling right to the shoulders and back. And you have to look at the book to see all these photographs and understand. And then as a physician, in my life, we had the opportunity a number of occasions to go, you know, in autopsy rooms, morgues, etc., even with doing dissection as a young medical student. And it's if you followed me into any of these rooms and you turn the body over of these poor souls who have died, and you turn over the body, you see that the back is flat, the buttocks is flat, and the legs, some parts of the gastric muscles are flattened because of the weight of the body, and it just remains that way, flattened. And when you look at the back and you compare that with the back of the man of the shroud, you find that the man of the shroud is not, there's no areas of flattening. If there were, we'd have great areas of the same gray, which would show it was flattening, large areas of the back, large areas of the buttocks. You have none of that. What you have is form. You have the form of a body of a man who's upright. And so what we have here is definite evidence, visual evidence, that tells us that the man of the shroud is upright. Basically, what we have is you have a man who is taken down from a crucified position, laid out on a cloth. The blood marks are consistent with a man who's been laid out on the cloth. However, the image itself is, in contrast to that, is the image of a man who is literally upright. And is actually I remember thinking in terms, well, he's upright, he's resurrected, why isn't he standing on his feet? And actually you see that the legs are crossed as if he was in the crucified position, with one leg over, 1 foot over the other. And I said, I didn't know what to do with that. Basically was looking at a man who is literally upright and in midair. And I didn't know what to do with that. So I ended up saying, well, I guess I'm going to have to go to the Gospels. And I started reading Mark and Luke and Matthew, and I found nothing about an upright man in midair with regard to Jesus. And then I got to the Gospel of John and got to chapter 12, verse 32. And Jesus himself stated, "And I, when I am lifted up above the earth, will draw people to myself." I'll repeat that. "And I, when I am lifted up above the earth, will draw people to myself." And I said, my gosh, this describes exactly what I am looking at on the shroud. Being lifted up above the earth is exactly what I'm looking at, of a man in midair, lifted up above the earth. And, of course, the next sentence it says, he was talking about his crucifixion. So, but as I study this further and I went into the Bible further, and I went to commentaries like Raymond Brown, actually in the first part of his book, one of the introductions of his book, he says the culminating event in his career, Jesus' career, is when he's lifted up in death and resurrection to heaven. He will draw all people to himself. And it turns out that when Jesus talks about being lifted up within the Gospel of John, it doesn't just mean crucifixion, because otherwise there would be no eternal life. We would not know that he is God, which he states. So it turns out that what that means, lifted up throughout, it means that lifted up in crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension back to the Father. That's what that means by lifted up. It's really the hour of glory that is being discussed there each and every time. So what we have is Jesus does talk about this three times about being lifted up, and that's what we see on the shroud. He's lifted up in crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension back to the Father. That's what we're seeing. And we have even more data and fascinating data with regard to what John thinks and whatever, things you can tie together. You have a whole six chapters in the Gospel of John where you discover, you can see that you can appreciate he knew about the shroud and its meaning, and he is trying to communicate that to you. So the only way to really understand the Shroud of Turin is to understand it through the life of Jesus, which John, the gospel writer, does. And I think the big question is for a lot of people, they say, well, he hasn't, nothing's been said about the image of the man of the shroud in his book. So, you know, he doesn't write about it. And if it was such a phenomenal experience, why would he not tell anybody about it? And when you start to explore that, you realize, and I did explore that in Josephus, which is a historian that lived at the time of John. He makes it very clear. The Jewish people would not accept images of men, a man, or on anything, because if it those were considered objects of idolatry, and those things would be taken and destroyed and thrown into the Dead Sea. So John knew that, and so therefore he had this image, but he knew that he had to conceal it. There was no way that he could talk about it, and if he didn't conceal it, it would have been destroyed. So, and this is what we discover in the book, that he hides it and conceals it, and then finally leaves clues, wonderful clues, of how he and it relates it to us that really he did see it, and you understand that he saw it. And that's all. It's a little more. That's too complex to get into. That's something you'll have to read about in the book, The Shroud
Absolutely.
Of Jesus.
Yeah. So the book is The Shroud of Jesus and the Sign John Ingeniously Concealed by Dr. Gilbert Lavoie, Lavoie. It's published by Sophia Institute, so it's available on Sophia's website, as well as here locally. If you go out to the St. Jude shop, you can get it from the store. And I think it may also be available on EWTN, if I'm not mistaken, Doctor, right?
Oh, yeah, EWTN, yeah. And yeah. Sophia, and, Pauline Media bookstores should have it now, okay. and other bookstores, even Barnes & Noble, I think, have it. And of course, you know, the internet, Amazon, and all those places. So it's available. We should be supporting our Catholic bookstores.
Absolutely. We have just a minute left. Any final word, Doctor, before we have to let you go?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you and your wonderful audience for, first of all, having me. Thank you for having me and your wonderful audience for being out there listening. We hope that you will all go out there and buy the book. Any money that's made on this book goes back to the book. I don't make any. You never make money on Shroud books anyway, but it would go back to the book to promote the idea. What we really should do, hopefully do with this book is we're losing about 40% of our young people are going to no faith. Our young, and so we want to use this kind of information. This is visual information. God is communicating to us in a visual way, and we want to bring this to our youth so that they will see that God is real, that eternal life is real, that the Holy Spirit is real, that the bread of life is real. So we want to get that out and use it to evangelize our youth.
Very good. Thank you for your time, Doctor. I appreciate it. To Michael and the folks at WTMR, thank you for your assistance today. And for our listeners, thank you. I look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Till then, I pray that God will hold you in the palm of his hand. Take care, and God bless.